Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Christopher Scott, and I'm here with Jonathan Medair. How are you, Jonathan?
Pretty good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very good indeed, very good indeed. We're here at Rathvinny Vineyards and the new winery facility that's just been almost finished, or pretty much finished.
Yes, for a couple of months, but yeah, it's still a brand new building.
Brand new. It does look brand new as well. The odd snagging list, as you were saying, when we tried to set up the recorder, the power at one of the points didn't quite work. So.
Yes, no, we are nearly there though.
Yep, brilliant. What we're going to talk about today is a wee bit about the process of going through and setting up a winery for the very first time, looking at some of the kit you've purchased, some of the decisions in terms of how the winery has been put together, some of the decisions you haven't quite made yet because you haven't quite made your first vintage, and just try and get a feel for that side of it. But before we get into that, just a wee bit about yourself, Jonathan. How long have you been making wine?
It's about over 15 years now. Yes, I was trained in Champagne, in Reims. So I worked a bit in Champagne. I then traveled to the US, to California, where I spent about 10 years. These 10 years, I actually left for a year. I went to Virginia.
Virginia, I know they make wine in every state, but Virginia's not the hotbed of winemaking that California is.
It's a really different climate, but Virginia produces really, really nice wines, including sparkling, actually.
Yep. Are you a sparkling specialist?
I hope I am. Yeah. I've been working in both sparkling and still wine, so I hope this can bring something a bit different than.
So you worked in the States, anywhere else?
No. Then we moved here in 2012.
So you've been on board with Rathvinny now for what was 2014 now, so a couple of years. In fact, when I came out last time and interviewed Mark and Cameron, you were around, but there wasn't a lot to talk to you about at that stage.
No, I was, and I was probably around. Probably in the, we had, our office used to be a porta cabin, so I was probably in there, yes.
Yeah. And now you've got lots of nice new facilities. Well, let's talk a wee bit about the winery anyway, as it was built. Did you have much control over the design of the actual building itself? Because it is a multi-level building. There seems to be three levels to this building.
Yes, this was already planned. I was lucky enough to be there. Just after that, I worked with Gerard De Villiers, who is our consultant. He is based in South Africa. Mm-hmm. He's an engineer, and he's involved in a lot of wineries developments. So I worked with him to figure out, you know, how to really optimize the space. Because of planning restrictions, the area we have to work with is limited.
Yeah.
So the building currently looks quite large, but really soon it's going to be full of tanks and it's going to be quite a tight space. So, yes, we had to work with that and try and make the most, you know, workable and practical space really to work in.
As you say, it's got a lot of, there are tanks set up, there's equipment all over the place really. It's, well, let's follow a typical process. You know, your first harvest, which is hopefully going to be coming up very shortly this summer. How would that go through the building? But also, what equipment have you chosen? Why have you chosen it? What sizing equipment? All that sort of stuff. So, where do the grapes get received in? I presume Cameron's involved with the picking side of things.
Yes, logistics of picking should be Cameron.
He's the viticulturist.
He's the viticulturist. Prior to harvest, he and I will be going in the vineyard trying to decide on the ideal picking date for the different varieties we have. Then it will be dropped right in front of the winery, actually where you parked.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And from there, I'll take care of the fruit. So we currently own two presses. One is Scharfenberger. It's a German brand.
Yep.
It's used quite commonly in Champagne. It's a bladder pneumatic press.
So it has a steel wall and it just inflates a balloon in the inside.
Correct.
Yep.
And then it squeezes the grapes and the juice drops in a tray below the press.
Yep.
This has a 2-ton capacity. And we also purchased a Coquard Press. Coquard, they are based in Reims.
Yeah, they're the ones that a lot of the bitter English wine producers are using.
Yes, it's a really, really nice press. It's hydraulic and it produces really good quality juice. It's a really efficient pressing.
Again, is it a bladder that blows up? Or?
No, this one is it's a plate attached to a hydraulic piston. So it's literally just two plates getting closer to each other and squeezing the grapes.
A bit like the old traditional basket press, really, isn't it, in terms of the way it squeezes it?
Yes, exactly. Except that the press you're talking about, that's what we would call a vertical press.
Yeah, so you'd have a screw in that would screw down onto the grapes.
And then the plate would come up and you would have to step in the press and shovel, you know, the grapes to reorganize so that you could squeeze again. This press, it's basically inclined.
Yeah.
So when the plate comes closer to the, well, one plate is stationary, the other one moves. So when the plate that moves comes as close as possible to the other one, we have squeezed enough, the plate backs up. And because of the way, what we call the cake should fall by itself. And then we can press again. So it recreates that. We call it retrousse. Retrousse is the process of remixing the grapes inside the press to kind of homogenize. So the retrousse is done. It's automatic.
Less work. Always good.
Yes. Yep.
Okay. And a lot of people talk about bladder press as being very gentle because it isn't plates, but champagne and traditional sparkling wines tend to be, you don't tend to squeeze them too much. So how does it work that you got this big slab of steel pressing up against things, but it's still quite hard, isn't it?
Yes, well, there are pressure sensors that will monitor the quality of the juice coming out of that. Of course, we'll adjust parameters if we have to, in case it happens that we feel like we are over-extracting or squeezing too hard. But overall, you know, we'll try to stay in the 1.2 bar and...
1.2 bar.
At the maximum.
Yeah. Okay. And tell me, you've got two presses. You've got a small one and a big one. And I think when you showed me around the winery, it's got room for 6 or 8 presses all up when you're fully up and running.
We should have 4 of the Coquard.
Yep.
The first one we got is actually only 4-ton capacity. In the future, when we are fully up and running, we should have 4 Coquard of 8-ton capacity.
That's quite a lot of press. Why didn't you just buy one of those to start off with?
As we start and get some fruit from the estate, we would like to isolate as many lots as possible. Could it be from one block or from one variety? Could it be Chardonnay? We really want to isolate as much as we can to really assess the quality of what we get. In order to do that, we thought that the smaller the press, the more flexibility we have.
Yeah, but you couldn't just put a small amount in a big press and...
No, I think in the 4-ton capacity, going below 2.5 is probably not a good idea. So that's why we got also a small 2-ton.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. And so the grapes come in, but you said there are whole bunches, hand harvest, which gives whole bunches.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, if you get a machine harvester, it shakes a bejeebus out of the grapes and you don't get any stalks, or not many stalks. But if you're doing whole bunches, hand harvesting, won't you land up with stalks? Do you press with the stalks on, or are you...
Yes, we'll press the whole cluster. Yes. It's the traditional champagne method, which it creates inside the press as soon as you start and squeeze, it creates channels, and it pulsates. It's a bit of a natural filtration because the juice has to go through all these paths.
The juice just tracks along the stems, and that gives a bit of openness, I suppose, for that.
And it should get a bit of a cleaner juice.
Okay, but you've got a destemmer here as well, haven't you? What's that for?
We do. Because we will be producing some sparkling rosé, we wanted to keep the option of making a red wine from Pinot Noir, a red wine that we could blend with other wines to create that rosé. So we have that ready. We can actually receive Pinot Noir, destem it, sort it, and then we have some red fermenters. We can make a red wine, and we'll see how it goes. We might also try some skin contact just press after skin contact and get that pink wine.
Okay. Oh, that makes sense. Yes, because you don't really want to leave the juice in contact with the stalks, because that's where you get a lot of the bitter tannins, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. No. We would do that destemmed, destalked.
Yep. Okay, that makes sense. And I noticed when we first came in, you receive the grapes at one level, but all the tanks are lower. What's the reasoning for that?
Well, the press sits about 6 meters from what we call level zero, which is where all the tanks are. So once we press the grapes, the juice can flow by gravity into the tanks. So at this stage, there's no need for a pump. It's gentle on the juice, and we believe it helps with the quality.
Why are you worried about a pump, though? Because pumps are quite common in wineries. Is that just that stage, or are you trying to be gravity fed all the way through?
No, we're not going to be gravity fed all the way, but for us it's quite an important stage, because there are, even though we have good quality presses, there are quite a lot of solids in suspension, and we feel that at this stage any pump that would be hard on solids, that would disintegrate them, and say you have a few seeds, anything that would be damaged then could transfer bad components to the wine, juice.
I suppose if you ever bite into a seed, it's quite bitter, isn't it? So if you rip the seeds, then you can get all those bitter phenolics,
yes,
getting into the wine.
So we want to avoid all of this and try and be as natural as possible, really.
Yeah. And so you just let all that settle out, is it? Is that the idea?
Yes. Then we will transfer by gravity to a settling tank, where we'll leave the juice 12, 24 hours, it will depend, and we let it settle naturally.
And is there anything special about the settling tanks? Do they have to be a particular style, or is just any old tank will do?
Any tank will do, but we picked a ratio that we think was a good compromise between settling and also fermentation. Especially for fermentation, you do not want tanks that are too tall.
Okay. What's that?
Because then you have a temperature gradient that becomes too large. You can get issues with sulfur compounds. A ratio of 1 to 2, for example, is, we believe, is pretty good.
So one wide but 2 high as a ratio.
We are around that, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay. And so you use the same tanks for settling as fermentation, but you've chosen them.
We have, in theory, dedicated tanks for settling. But okay. I believe that at some stage in the winemaking process, we will reuse them. If not for fermentation, at least for storage after.
And I had a look at your tanks. They're all bright stainless steel tanks. Are they expensive?
That's a question for Mark. If you want my opinion, they're really good quality.
All right. And you've got heaters. I saw you mentioned that you've got both heaters and chillers on the tank.
Yes, we can both warm up the tank or cool it down.
Why would you want to warm up a tank? Because I know people like to chill wines down to retain the freshness of the wines and fruit flavor.
Yes, and to to keep a steady fermentation. But we thought that we get harvest quite late. So say October, November, the weather, or earlier, I hope, but the weather starts to cool down. So you get to the end of your alcoholic fermentation and you try to keep your wine at, say, 16, 17 Celsius. Then you want to, for example, go on with your malolactic. This is really temperature sensitive, and 16, 17 is actually a bit low. 20, 21 Celsius would be an ideal temperature.
Yeah, England's not that known to be that warm in winter, is it?
I didn't think so. So if we want to maintain this temperature, or if we want to rise the temperature to 20, we have that option.
Okay. And I actually thought maybe you wanted, during alcoholic fermentation, that's exothermic. You're getting heat being generated,
yep,
which is great. But sometimes if it's too cold, maybe the fermentation doesn't kick off by itself, or will it be? You're not worried about that?
I'm not worried yet, because I've never had that happen.
Yeah,
but this is England. So no, I don't see that being a problem. But again, it's a good safety. It's a good backup to have in case we have temperature issues.
Excellent. All right, then. I think we're going to wrap it up there, Jonathan.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Well.